You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Folks, we're going to really just get going up with our next poll. It's kind of a rolling program here. Grab some coffee. There's more donuts there for out there. You're requesting chocolate donuts. I appreciate that. And so the next poll that we have, we're really, really thrilled. We have a panel called Location Tracking by the Government After Jones. What is Jones, the Supreme Court decision? Tell us about mobile app and app tracking. And we're very, very pleased that we have a great lineup of folks to kind of hack through this for the next half hour. Yesterday, the other day, I think 4 days ago, the Congressional Research Service released their report on the United States Force Jones GPS monitoring, property, and privacy. So it's a good read by the Congressional Research Service. So I direct your attention to that. But, so today, Jared Franklin from the Constitution Project, attorney, has agreed to moderate our discussion, and I'll hand it over to her. Thanks, Jared.
Thank you. I'm Sharon Brown Franklin, Senior Counsel with the Constitution Project, and I'm joined here, as you know, by Greg Bowdoin. I'm a Senior Counsel with the Center for Privacy and Technology, and Jason Weinstein, who is Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the Department of Justice. So I just want to set the stage briefly for our conversation, which comes off a Supreme Court decision you're probably aware of, the GPS tracking case for United States versus Jones. And I don't want to get into too much legalese here, but just give you a little bit of background for our conversation. So this is a case in which the court began to grapple with the issue of how does the Fourth Amendment apply in the digital age? And do modern technology and the very powerful surveillance tools we have available today change the analysis in any way? And how do we continue to draw appropriate lines so that law enforcement can do its appropriate work, but we still protect constitutional safeguards? So in this case, Mr. Jones argued that a valid search warrant should be required before the police could install a GPS tracking device on his car and track him continuously. And the court unanimously agreed that if the police install a GPS tracking device on an individual's property and use that device continuously in this period of about 4 weeks, 24/7, that this constitutes a search under the Fourth Amendment. But the court issued three separate opinions to get to that result, and I just want to give you a very brief encapsulation of the differences. The majority opinion by Justice Scalia focused on a more traditional trespass analysis and the fact that the police had interfered with Mr. Jones' property rights when they actually physically stuck the device on his car, and that was said constituted a search under the Fourth Amendment. We also have an opinion, the main concurrent author by Justice Alito, joined by three other justices, which focused on the court's more traditional privacy analysis, something called the reasonable expectation of privacy test. And they said when you're looking at this very powerful electronic surveillance, this is something new and different. And even though we're only talking about it in a public place, this violates a reasonable expectation of privacy. And it didn't matter whether the police actually physically installed the device or not. The final opinion was by Justice Sotomayor. She actually joined the majority's analysis on the physical intrusion analysis, but wrote separately, also echoing concerns under the reasonable expectation of privacy test, and highlighting something which the other justices addressed, which is something called the third-party doctrine, which is just worth flagging for you, even though we can't go into too much detail on that today. And that's a doctrine coming from a 1976 case that says, when you voluntarily turn over your information to a third party, like a bank, or perhaps looking for a cell phone provider, you lose your privacy interest in that. And so the government can get your information directly from that third party without having to get a traditional warrant. And Justice Sotomayor said, you know, in today's world, particularly in today's digital world, where so much of our interactions in life requires that kind of disclosure, maybe we need to rethink that doctrine. So that's the stage of the Jones case, and we're going to skip over opening statements here, but just move right into a series of questions trying to say what does this case mean moving forward. So first, I want to turn to Jason and ask you this. So some legal commentators have focused on the fact that in the majority of cases,
harbinger of technology and privacy law and a harbinger of major changes in the law and climate, and others have viewed it as a more limited opinion and certainly the legal basis for the holding of the majority of people is somewhat limited, as Jeremy just alluded to. It's also worth putting in perspective that the decision simply highlighted the need for a search warrant in situations where it wasn't entirely clear before that one was necessary. And consistent with that decision, our prosecutors are now being advised on a nationwide to get a search warrant in any case in which they want to put a tracker on a car, unless there is some documented exception to the warrant requirement that would apply. It's worth noting, by the way, for those not familiar with the facts of Jones, that in that case, that the officers did in fact get a warrant, but it turned out not to be a valid warrant for some technical reasons. They executed it 11 days after it was issued, as opposed to 10 days. They executed it in Maryland, and the warrant was issued in D.C. These guys weren't cowboys. They actually did try to take a step to getting a warrant. It just happened not to be technically valid one. And in my experience, certainly what I would talk to prosecutors in my career as an AOSA, and what I would always do in my own cases, even pre-Jones, is to get a court order based on probable cause to use a tracker, even if it's the type that was used in the Jones case. That is one that is slapped onto the car and not physically installed into the vehicle. And the simple reason for that is because, not because we all knew at that time that 20 years later, the court was going to say that that's a trespass, but because it makes it possible for you to monitor the signals coming from that tracker in a private space. If you, for purpose of not being a warrant, and the pre-Jones error was that it's not a Fourth Amendment event to put the tracker on, and as long as you only monitor the car when it's on public roads, the Fourth Amendment is restricted. Okay. But oftentimes, criminals choose to do their criminal activity not on public roads. It's a simple matter if you have a drug case in which a drug dealer pulls the car to a garage to meet a colleague or a co-conspirator, and they do the exchange of the drugs or the money in a private garage. There's some litigation risk if you don't have a warrant and you're monitoring the signals in what is arguably a private space. So, in my view, the best practice of the pre-Jones was to get a tracker. And I think now the best practice is now become a required practice.
Thank you. So, I want to ask Greg in turn. We're talking now about Jones, which is exclusively a constitutional holding. Of course, when you're looking at location tracking and what is legal, we also have some statutes in play, including the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, or ACPA. And there's been a lot of litigation going on before Jones and since Jones, and we have some differences in the courts. So I want to see if Greg can lay the stage for you a little bit of what is the current state of play in the courts on whether and when a warrant is required to get cell phone location tracking information, which is a little bit different than the Minnesota physical GPS tracker.
So Jones was a watershed opinion. And the reason it's particularly important is because in that case, there were about 3,000 GPS devices in active use placed by federal law enforcement. But today, there are about 323 million of these tracking devices held by people. And the big elephant in the room for Jones was, what about cell phone location data? And so far, the courts have not been consistent in deciding what should be the standard for cell phone location data. Some courts have said, well, if it's real time, maybe you need a warrant. And some courts haven't said that. And others have said, for stored, you don't need a warrant. But some courts have now said that magistrates can require warrants. The Third Circuit reached that decision, and that question about the stored location for a cell tower is now in front of the Fifth Circuit as well. And then there's the issue about what is the nature of the location information being sought? Is it GPS data, or is it cell tower data? GPS data has traditionally been thought to be more precise than cell tower data. But that distinction, I think, is being called into question today, because as more and more of us get more and more of these location-aware devices, the cell sectors are shrinking. Some cell sectors cover just a floor of a building, and some cell sectors cover just a room. So, this guy, he's not going to, his GPS is not going to work inside this building. But if there's a cell sector inside this room, all of a sudden I'm located much more precisely with this cell tower location information than I am with GPS. So the way the technology is moving suggests that location
conversation on the Fourth Amendment, and we have the statutory law, which is in some flux in the interpretation coming from the courts. So the question is obviously an open one of what is the standard now for law enforcement access to cell phone location information. So, Jason, do you believe that Congress has any role here, should be acting here? Do we need, for law enforcement purposes, some greater clarity on what the standard should be?
The short answer is yes, but I won't stick to the short answer. So, although, as I said before, people can disagree about the magnitude of the impact of Jones, I think everybody can agree if you read the opinion that the Supreme Court has essentially placed the ball in Congress's court. Justice Alito said in his opinion that a legislative body is best situated to draw a detailed line to balance privacy and public safety in a comprehensive way. And I think that's right. In fact, that reflects the way our system is supposed to work. Congress sets the rules of the road for law enforcement. Prosecutors have to follow those rules, and judges make sure that those rules are being followed properly, and where those rules need to be clarified, as was the case in Jones, to clarify them. And that system of checks and balances, I think, is a critical component to protecting all of our privacy. The reason why I say my short answer is yes, and that there's a need for some congressional action in the area of cell phone location information is because courts have come out in different ways with respect to cell tower information. And maybe if I may just sort of break down what our view is of the legal standard that applies to three different types of cell phone location information. First, there's cell tower information. Mark Ekamada from the Office of Enforcement Operations in here, he knows more about cell tower information than anyone I've ever met. In fact, argue the Third Circuit case that Greg just mentioned. So I will not do justice to the explanation that he did give, but as I think most of you know, to complete a call or to complete the transmission of a text message during the actual operation of the call or during the sending of the message, the network of your provider has to be able to identify the cell tower and sometimes the 120-degree pie slice sector of that tower that is closest to you or closest to the person to whom you're communicating. It needs that information just for the operation of the network to be able to complete the transmission. And providers create and maintain those records in the ordinary course of business. It's a necessary aspect of providing wireless service, to use the language of the third-party doctrine in Miller and Smith. Those records are not private papers. They are records of a transaction in which the provider is a participant. They're business records of the provider. And the provider has to create and maintain those records. They're not created in the direction of law enforcement. They are not nearly as precise as GPS, even in an urban environment. They reveal only the physical location of the cell tower that's serving a call. In some cases, because of network traffic, it might not actually be the cell tower that is closest to you. Depending on call volume, I'm sorry, depending on cell tower density, it could be miles and miles. The range of the tower could be, a few hundred yards in the most dense urban area. And it's far less precise. And within the range of cell tower information, there's two types. There's historical, that is, what cell tower your call was hitting off 60 days ago when you made a phone call. Perspective. Over the course of the next 30 days, what cell towers were your phone getting off of when you made calls? Generally speaking, although there's some disagreement, and as Greg noted, the Third Circuit issued an opinion, which you'll be stunned to hear that the court disagrees with, in which it said that even if the statutory standard is met, the court can require a higher standard. But generally speaking, the standard for historical cell tower information is what we call specific and articulable facts, sort of best understood and more easily pronounced as reasonable suspicion. For prospective cell tower, there is a significant split that's developed among the courts throughout the country, in some cases within the same courthouse, and in some cases within the same circuit, as to whether the standard should be specific and articulable facts or whether a search warrant should be required based on probable cause. I practiced most recently in the state district, but in 2005 switched from being a reasonable suspicion to a probable cause district. I can explain the implications of that later. Putting cell tower information aside, so you've got reasonable suspicion for historical. You've got, in some courts, reasonable suspicion, in some specific articulable facts, in some courts, probable cause for prospective cell tower. And then there comes GPS, which we'll broadly call GPS, but with the understanding that it's not always GPS technology, but what you might understand is precision location information. Our practice and what we tell our prosecutors throughout the country is to get a search warrant. That may be a surprise to some of you, given some of the rhetoric about Jones and its implications, but let's say it again. When we seek to use your cell phone to get GPS or precise location information, we get a search tracking their movements in a private space. So there are constitutional implications to that. So for that reason, or for those reasons and others, we have, as long as I can remember, and I've been doing this since the late 90s, as long as I can remember, the department's position has been that when you're using precise location information to track the phone, you get a search warrant. But those conflicting interpretations as the cell tower information are really what is creating a lot of uncertainty, and there really is no fairness and no justice when the law applies differently to different people depending on what courthouse you're sitting in, or you're standing in as the defendant. And so for that reason alone, we think that Congress should clarify the legal standard for historical and prospective cell tower information, and as I think you probably tell from my remarks, I think that the standard the Congress should come to is a consistent, specific, and articulable back standard.
So we have actually consensus among the three of us up here that there is a role for Congress. Greg's organization, Center for Democracy and Technology, is heading up a coalition called the Digital Due Process Coalition. And my organization, the Constitution Project, is a member. It includes a broad coalition of business groups by tech companies, as well as privacy advocacy groups, seeking some legislation here. And so I'm going to ask Greg to describe for you all, as far as location tracking, what the goals of GDPR, as well as there are some bills already pending in Congress that would address some of these issues, and what the state of play is there.
So one of the principles that we agreed in the digital process early on was the principle of tech neutrality. That it shouldn't matter whether location is being determined by, for example, cell tower location or by GPS. And when you look down the road, where cell tower location information is going, it's becoming more and more precise. And I commend to you some testimony outside by Matt Glaze, a professor at UPenn, in June 24, 2010. He really lays it out. He explains how cell site location information is becoming as precise and may become even more precise than GPS. And I mentioned some of those factors earlier. Our group, Digital Due Process, includes a lot of the companies that you know well, Adobe, Amazon, Apple, AT&T, eBay, Facebook, Google, Intel, Microsoft, Quest, and a lot of the civil liberties and privacy groups that you know well, and they span the political spectrum. Also, you've got ACLU and Americans for Tax Reform. CDT and EFF and a lot of the other privacy groups. And we all settled on four recommendations. One of them is that a government entity should be able to access or require another entity to provide prospectively or retrospectively location information regarding a mobile communications device only with a warrant based on a showing of probable cause. So for both prospective and retrospective location, we said there should be a warrant. For GPS and cell tower, we said there should be a warrant. And there are two pieces of legislation that have been introduced on location. One is the GPS Act, Senate side, S-1212, widened as the leader. And it would require warrants for both stored and prospective location. House site counterpart, Chief Fitz is the leader, H.R. 2168. And then Senator Leahy has the Act of Amendments Act, S-1011, and the Leahy bill would require a warrant for real-time and specific and articulable facts for stored.
Thank you. So, Jason, I don't think you're in a position to give an official DOJ position on this legislation, but you have alluded to your belief that if Congress should act, it should, for cell phone location information, impose a lower standard than what the court has said is required for the GPS tracking. When we're talking about a GPS device, could you explain why you believe the lower standard is appropriate in the case of cell phone information?
Sure. And I can't comment on a particular piece of legislation, but I can articulate some general principles, but I would say that the department appreciates greatly the efforts of Senator Leahy and Senator democracy truly does enhance privacy, but without compromising public safety. Let me explain why I think that a warrant, a uniform warrant standard for all types of location information without regard to its procedure or the way it's generated and maintained is a mistake. Probable cause is a standard that we follow historically in American law enforcement for our most intrusive techniques, search warrants in your home, wiretaps, now GPS information on your cell phone. But it's important to keep in mind that we don't start our investigations with probable cause. We build up to probable cause using less intrusive techniques. We have to use these less intrusive techniques as building blocks, if you will, to develop enough evidence to overcome a probable cause standard. Cell tower information is a very important one of those building blocks. It's used routinely in the early stages of criminal investigations, national security terrorism investigations, when the government just doesn't have probable cause for a warrant, to try to develop enough evidence to get over that hurdle. And the failure to distinguish between different types of location information and to require probable cause for all types would cripple, and I don't use that term lightly, would cripple many law enforcement and national security investigations before they can really reach their goal. It would make it substantially harder to get this information and solve crimes, and in some cases it would make it just impossible, as I mentioned before. I practiced as a name and say a district that almost overnight went from being a specific and articulable facts district for prospective cell tower information to a warrant district. And our ability to get prospective cell tower information to solve violent crimes, I was the chief of the violent crime section, so most of my time was spent solving murders and gang-related crimes, for which cell tower information was as critical as guns and bullets into solving these crimes, and we lost, essentially lost the ability to use prospective cell tower information to solve those cases, and in fact, made it impossible to solve many of them. This has very real consequences. We talk about this as if it's just electronic crimes and data, but the consequences are real in a very human way. Cell tower information is used to find missing children, to solve abductions, to catch child pornographers, to catch murderers, and you know, we refer to specific and articulable facts as a lower standard than probable cause, and to be sure that it is, but it is not a low standard. That is a meaningful standard that provides a substantial degree of privacy protection. In fact, back in 1994, when Congress raised the standard for historical cell tower records from just a subpoena to this current standard of specific and articulable facts, it was embraced by the privacy community and by privacy groups as protecting our privacy. And in fact, one leading privacy advocate held that new standard as a significant privacy advance and said that that new standard would confer a high degree of protection that would prevent phishing expeditions. The person who said that was Jerry Berman, who's the founder of this caucus and at the time was the executive director of EFF. And although I don't find myself often in the position of bringing up EFF, he was exactly right. It is a high standard. It is a meaningful standard. And anyone who thinks it's a rubber stamp, I would submit, has never actually tried to get it, the order signed in the District of Maryland.
Can I allow at least a little bit of time for our questions? I'd like to give a quick opportunity to respond on why the probable cause standard is not likely hampering law enforcement and is appropriate. And I want to have time for a couple questions from the audience.
Exactly. The same argument was made in Jones. Exactly. It will cripple law enforcement. The criminals will run roughshod over law-abiding people. And Jones came out the other way. Not one justice accepted the Department of Justice's argument in that case. It got zero votes. The court reached its decision, and guess what? We're all here. The criminals are not taking over the country, and things are going to work out okay. Listen, any time Congress legislates in this area, it has to be very careful. One good thing about Congress stepping in, as opposed to relying on the courts to make these constitutional decisions, is that Congress can look carefully at where exceptions might need to be made to a strong probable cause standard. One exception would need to be made for emergencies. That's already in the Wiretap Act. It's already in that, but we would expect it would be available for location information as well. Another would be child kidnapping cases. You want the parents to be able to consent if their child is abducted and the child is regarded as the owner or operator or controller of the cell phone. So I think that it's important to remember that probable cause is not a straitjacket. It can be applied in ways that can both facilitate law enforcement investigations and protect privacy. And it's up to Congress to really make that happen.
Okay, I think I've got just a couple of questions. I want to ask you, though, to please identify yourself and please actually ask a question, especially
question. There's a couple of minutes about law enforcement and privacy that I think have to be addressed. When law enforcement see the access to your electronic communications, I say to you or to people's electronic communications, it is for the purpose of solving crimes. It's for the purpose of catching criminals. The average citizen doesn't have their accounts accessed by law enforcement. In fact, you know, Google collects information about law enforcement requests that it gets every 6 months. And in the first 6 months of 2011, law enforcement at every level of the United States, state, federal, local, anybody with a badge in America, made a request of Google for suspects' internet account. Added up to 11,000 users, which is 0.03% of all Google users. And when we seek that information for the purpose of solving crimes, we have to get lawful process. There is as I said at the outset, there's a check and balance. It doesn't have to warrant probable cause is not the only legal standard that provides for meaningful judicial review. We have to get a court order in many cases. We have to get any kind of electronic information about your internet use or cell phone use. And we do that through the check and balance that an independent judiciary provides. In fact, your cell phone information about the location that's derived from your cell phone is already more protected than any of an array of information that you leave behind living on the grid, as we all do, in the ordinary course of your day. Most of the location information that you leave behind over the course of your travels today that don't involve the use of your cell phone, we can get with a subpoena. But if it relates to your cell phone, if it relates to your internet use, a court order is required, and there's robust judicial review. To your question, I think, also raises one other issue, which is when we focus on privacy, when people talk about privacy, they always talk about privacy vis-a-vis law enforcement, they don't focus on the fact that while 0.03% of internet users have to worry about their accounts being accessed to, as part of a criminal investigation, 100% of cell phone internet users need to worry about how providers are using their information. I suspect that the last panel was something of an eye-opener for many people, those here and those watching on the web, because most people are just unaware of how the providers that they use, either for the phone or for their various internet applications, use and sell their information for commercial purposes. There is substantial restriction on law enforcement's ability to access information in a criminal investigation. There is essentially no restriction legally on a provider's ability to use your information, private information, location information, for commercial purposes, and that's something that has to be part of the privacy discussion as well.
Well, it's not the subject. I mean, yes, there are commercial privacy challenges where you're talking about law enforcement access to location information. Look, I think it's your question was very telling, because back in the day when Jerry Berman praised the intermediate level of scrutiny for this transactional information, there was a heck of a lot less of it. It would be very hard in 1986 to be able to anticipate the level of intrusion that could be achieved through gathering up all kinds of transactional information, where you were at a particular moment, what you purchased, what your friends are, when you communicated with them, who you communicated with back in 86, we had a cell phone. People who had cell phones in 86, they looked like bricks. There were maybe 100,000 of them max available. They were not commonly being used. So today, we have all kinds of transactional records and a clear picture of a person's activities can be revealed through that transactional information. I think Justice Sotomayor was onto something, like she said in Jones. I'm not sure that the third-party records doctrine serves us well in the digital age, because I think that a lot of people wouldn't expect that the government would not need a warrant when it is, for example, getting a list of every website a person visited in the last week, or the last month, or the last year. We have time for one last question. Ask myself audio, this is from the previous panel. So consumers have the ability to swap their SIM cards or switch providers pretty quickly, or put their phone into airplane mode and just use Wi-Fi. Do you know the prevalence and standard required to push software onto devices like CPAP that would ping law enforcement and notify law enforcement of a user's location simply for devices that they can't get cell tower